Babble Radio, recorded on Friday, October 11th, 2024. I'm your host, Breanne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. Monday, October 7th, 2024, marked the one-year anniversary of the deadly Hamas-led attacks in Israel-Palestine, which was followed by Israel's ongoing genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza. Over the past year, activist organizations, groups, and citizens worldwide have done their part to call for an end to this genocide. One such organization is Independent Jewish Voices. Today, Louise Smith from Independent Jewish Voices sits down with Rabble editor Nick Seabrook to talk about the work her organization does to promote peace in the Middle East, how solidarity with Palestine does not equal anti-Semitism, and how all forms of oppression are connected. Here are Seabrook and Smith in conversation. Take a listen.
Hello, I'm Nick Seabrook, and I'm here today to speak with Louise Smith of Independent Jewish Voices. Louise, thank you so much for joining me today, and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
To begin, could you introduce yourself to our audience a little bit more and tell them a little bit about Independent Jewish Voices and what you do with Independent Jewish Voices?
Sure. So I live in Toronto, and I grew up in Toronto's Jewish community. My entire education from kindergarten to grade 12 was within the Jewish day school system. So Judaism has always been a very essential part of my life and my identity. And I joined IJV in 2019 because I was really beginning to despair about what I was seeing Palestinians posting about their daily lives in the West Bank and in Gaza. And I had known for a long time about inequalities for Palestinians and Jews in Israel and in the occupied territories, but really seeing those first-person experiences being shared online, it really made me understand the severity and the relentlessness of what they have to deal with. And it shocked me a bit about how little of it really makes its way over here to the Jewish community that I was part of. So IJV's thematic areas of work are Palestine solidarity, anti-racism and indigenous solidarity, and justice-oriented Jewish communities. So really the core belief within IJV is that you shouldn't have to choose between your Judaism and your support for Palestinian liberation or Palestinian human rights, and that we believe that all forms of oppression are intertwined, that we're in a shared struggle for the safety of all of our communities.
And prior to October 7th, what were some of the activities that IJV was engaged in on this issue to help raise awareness and rally support?
Yeah, so one of the really key things that the IJV community focuses on is that there are a lot of really strong voices in the Jewish community that are invested in confusing people about anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. And the Israel lobby and funders of the Israeli state, they really want people to be so afraid of being accused of anti-Semitism that they stop protesting any of the humanitarian violations committed by the state of Israel. And we really need to make a distinction between people who are critical of Jews for being Jewish or Jewish conspiracy theories that are focused on Jewish people or perceived Jewish traits, and separate that from legitimate criticism of state decisions. And it is very normal for people to criticize state actions, state policies, and that shouldn't be any different for the state of Israel. So we felt it has been important that while the Israel lobby plays on people's fears, we need to stand against the weaponization of Jewish grief and Jewish trauma to manufacture consent for apartheid and genocide. So it's a challenge because it's really pervasive. So we've had to make sure that people are educating city councilors, provincial representatives, federal representatives. There's a ton of activity that happens at the school board level that I was completely oblivious to until I started working with IJV and really seeing how relentlessly people are lobbied to try to make any criticism of Israel perceived to be anti-Semitic. And this is really threatening to other students and teachers and parents, Palestinian families, people who are allied with Palestinians, and just generally, communities that want to be able to fight racism against them. It really forces them to be so careful about how they approach that so that they don't get falsely accused of anti-Semitism, and then have professional or personal repercussions from that.
Absolutely, very important work. And 1 year ago this week, when October 7th happened, what was your reaction to that day? And what was the discussion going on inside IJV about what the next steps would be?
Of course, I mean, it was a shocking day for all of us. And any loss of human life is a terrible thing and could empathize with people's fears and concerns about what was going to happen and what had happened. And also just knowing that the reaction to it was likely to be also very concerning. So, one of the most significant things that happened in Toronto that I feel very fortunate to have been part of was that very soon after the events of October 7th, there was a call out for Jewish organizations and unaffiliated Jewish activists to come together, knowing that this would be an important time to reaffirm Jewish solidarity with Palestinians and their allies. So this coalition ended up becoming known as the Jews Say No to Genocide Coalition. And it includes a number of organizations or Jewish people from broader organizations. So it's Independent Jewish Voices, the United Jewish People's Order, If Not Now Toronto, the Jewish Faculty Network, and then Jewish members of Showing Up for Racial Justice, Toronto, and World Beyond War. So those organizations, so we came together in this coalition and really focused our efforts on being a loud, present, visible Jewish group to make it known that there was another way of looking at everything that's been going on in Israel-Palestine leading up to October 7th and in the aftermath of October 7th, and making sure that there was a voice to counterbalance what we knew was going to be coming from the pro-Israel Zionist lobby. We also saw a huge swelling of membership in IJV. Hundreds of new people signed up for the Toronto York Region chapter, and across the country, the number of regional, local, or university-based campuses chapters almost doubled since October 7th. And this really reflects what studies have also recorded that within Canada, Jewish attitudes to Israel have been, in a statistically significant way, there's been a decline in the emotional attachment that Canadian Jews feel to the state of Israel. And there was a study released by a professor of sociology in February 2024 that also compared attitudes to September 2023, and saw a dramatic decline in that emotional attachment. So we know that people are feeling alienated by the actions of the Israeli state, and that more and more they're finding common ground with people who have been doing this advocacy work with Palestinian allies.
Fantastic. And over the past year, we've seen many different turning points in domestically in terms of the protests and the campaigning for an end to the violence that's happening right now. We've seen the major protests at, say, businesses like Indigo Chapters. We've seen attempts in the House of Commons to pass motions to suspend arms sales to Israel. We've seen blockades in front of Canadian businesses that are have been participating in supplying arms and material to the Israeli military. How many of these events have you and IJV been involved with, and what are some of the, you think, some of the most important events in that character of protest and lobbying that have taken place over the past year?
Yeah, so I would say that too many to count. So there really has been, at one point there was weekly, there was always every, there was something. Every week there was at least one direct action, there was a protest, there was something happening. And, over the last year, there's also been a lot of other groups that have formed. Every riding has a Palestine solidarity group that has been formed. And so exponentially more and more people are joining defending the cause and are organizing their own things. So there really has been a huge increase in the numbers of participatory direct actions that people have been taking. For us, I think one of the key things is that IJV was the first national Jewish organization to endorse the Palestinian-led boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And that work has really become much more mainstream in the last year. And many more organizations are understanding that we do have direct connections to things that happen, that there are companies that are based here, there are individuals here who are either funding the things that are happening or directly manufacturing materials that are used against the population in Palestine. So we've seen a lot more knowledge about that and a lot more direct action as the things that you've mentioned. We have seen some real successes with that, and probably the most visible one that people are aware of was a sustained campaign to pressure Scotiabank to divest from Elbit Systems, which is an Israeli weapons manufacturer. And there's been a lot of pressure around that. And Scotiabank is very visible in the arts world. There's a lot of things that they sponsor. And so there's been a lot of pressure from within those communities to get them to divest, and also people who bank there really looking for them to make an intentional decision not to continue supporting that. And just this past August, there were reports that Scotia has cut its stake in Elbit by more than 40%. So these things can have an impact. You mentioned Indigo. So for Indigo, they have a charitable foundation that the founders of Indigo support. And it did have charitable status, which meant effectively that Canadian taxpayers were funding those activities, and their activities support the Israeli Defense Forces. So there's been a campaign for many, 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 many years. It's not a new thing. There have been activists that have been working on this for a long time. But finally, CRA has been, sorry, Canadian Revenue Agency has been going through the process of examining what exactly they've been funding and whether or not it's allowable under the Canadian rules. And they've determined, I mean, we think that it's clear that they're supporting a foreign army. And so that's something that there's some campaigning around. There have been other organizations that have had their charitable status revoked recently. So the Jewish National Fund, which buys up land and sort of obfuscates Palestinian ownership of that land, and they recently had their charitable status revoked because of the activities that they were undertaking. So applying pressure, this BDS approach, it can be effective, and we've seen some gains over the past year.
And I just want to dive a little bit more into something you mentioned earlier about, the purpose of IJV to counter some of the things coming out of the pro-Israel lobby and pro-Israel organizations that you feel is not accurate. For example, I'm thinking earlier this year, the student encampment protest at the University of Toronto, organizations like the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs and B'nai B'rith tried to classify this as being anti-Semitic and to have the encampment removed for those reasons. A judge later found that the protest was not anti-Semitic in nature, even though B'nai B'rith continued to claim that it was. I was just wondering, what was your reaction to the encampment protest movement and just using it as an example of what you mentioned earlier about classifying opposition to Israel, all opposition to Israel, as being anti-Semitic?
Yeah, thank you. I think a lot of the people, B'nai B'rith and Sija, and a lot of people who had complaints about the encampment did not actually spend time at the encampment. And if they did, it was explicitly to antagonize people. So they made a lot of comments, claims that people were blocked from going about their business on campus, that they weren't allowed into a certain area of campus. I think for listeners who have never been at the University of Toronto campus, might not have a clear visual of like what did it actually look like at the encampment. So just to paint a picture, if you imagine a circle, and there's a circle of buildings, and in the middle of that circle of buildings, there's a lawn. And the university had put up a fence around that lawn, and the encampment went inside that fence. So they were a fenced-in circle in the middle of this area of campus. They did not block anybody from going to class. They did not block anybody from getting into any of the buildings. And when people tried to force their way into the encampment because they wanted to make a point, they were turned away. So people weren't invited into the space if it was clear that they were there to antagonize the encampment residents. So there's footage online of people being, you know, not allowed in. But the context for that is why they were trying to get in to begin with. Inside the encampment itself, people are very knowledgeable about anti-Semitism. And before I'd ever met any Palestinians in Toronto, I was also not aware of how well informed they are. Every Palestinian person I have ever met really understands that difference, because they know that if they're going to be critical of Israel, they're going to be accused of anti-Semitism. And they can see the difference. And there were instances around the encampment when people would post hateful messages, and members of the encampment would call it out, and they had conversations about why something was anti-Semitic, and they were removed. And we saw this happen. So we know that they were taking care of that themselves. There were counter-protesters who came from the Jewish community and from some very aggressive far-right organizations like the Jewish Defense League, who make very violent, threatening posts. They would come down to the campus and they would say vile, horrible things, horrible, racist, anti-Arab, anti-Muslim, anti-queer, like just really, really horrible things. But it doesn't make it as much into the narrative that we all hear. So the calls for the encampment were to disclose and divest, for students to be able to understand where universities are spending their money. How are they spending the money? What are they investing in? They wanted transparency around it, which does not seem a lot to ask. So that was the key to what they were asking for, was, is the university complicit in supporting what is happening? That there's, you know, the bombardments, are they supporting the military complex over there? Like, they just wanted to know where their money was being spent. And that was the key ask from the encampment. So really very much focused on Israel.
You know, you mentioned earlier about the boycott, divest, sanctions movement against the state of Israel. And, you know, even prior to October 7th, organizations like B'nai B'rith and CIJA have been very vocally opposed in targeting those campaigns, claiming that they were anti-Semitic. And that's a trend that we've seen increase since October 7th of last year to any sort of protest movement that targets the state of Israel. I was just wondering, has IJV been a target of these organizations? And if so, how has IJV responded to these accusations from organizations like B'nai B'rith and CIJA?
Yeah, well, they love to try to delegitimize us. They like to claim that we're not real Jews, as if there's some universal definition of what makes someone an allowable Jew. So typically what they try to do is just diminish how Jewish we are and how many of us there are. And we're not really interested in trying to impress CIJA. Like, we don't see them as the focal point of what we're doing. And we give more credit to people than they do. We think that people, generally speaking, are smart enough to be able to tell the difference between criticizing a state and state actions and criticizing people just because they're Jewish. And there is a lot of actual anti-Semitism in the world. I'm not going to say that there's not, but CIJA and B'nai B'rith like to pretend that the anti-Semitism is coming from Muslims, Arabs, and Palestinians, when we know that actually what we need to be fighting is white supremacy and white nationalism. And often CIJA is happy to platform people who are white nationalists and racists, but are also Zionists. And we just find that so offensive. And the trade-off that they're willing to make between fighting anti-Semitism in only the ways that support the Israeli state, when we're in the diaspora, like, our fight should be about figuring out how to dismantle white supremacy and how it impacts everybody. And they can't see the importance of that. And they've managed to convince, unfortunately, many politicians that it is more politically expedient to fall in line with that. And that's really hard for us. And especially those of us who have really deep ties to Judaism and feel really connected and passionate about our Judaism, it's unfair for their line of attack to be diminishing my identity. Like, they shouldn't feel entitled to diminish my identity like that. And it's really at their risk for them to decide that we're too small to matter, because we're growing and we're building, and we're building connections with other communities. And it's fine if they don't want to take that seriously, because we know we're doing the important work.
If someone's listening to this show and they want to get involved, but they don't know how would you recommend that they can get involved?
Awesome question. Thank you. So if they're social media people, and they want to follow Independent Jewish Voices Canada, Independent Jewish Voices Toronto York Region, the Jews Say No to Genocide Coalition on Insta or Twitter or wherever. Also on the IGV website, if they're interested in joining up. So our membership is Jewish, but non-Jewish people can sign up as supporters. And also I would say that, you know, one of the most important things that Canadians can do right now is to pressure the Canadian government to establish a two-way arms embargo. We might not naturally think that Canada has a role in, you know, military kind of exports, imports, that kind of thing, but we do, tens of millions of dollars. And, you know, our government, Trudeau, Melanie Joly, they have these, at this point, pretty embarrassing speaking points. They still talk about wanting ceasefire. And, you know, at the same time, they're funding and arming the Israeli war machine. They've been talking about, you know, trying to support Canadians in Lebanon, getting people out of Lebanon, helping them leave. At the same time, they're like enabling the Israeli government's bombing of Lebanon. So it's like they're trying to talk out of both sides. And like, we need to hold them accountable and remind them that there are actually things they could do to limit the impact of this war. It's not even a war. It's completely one-sided, and they are funding and arming the aggressors, and they could stop doing that. So if people want to do something, arms embargo now, check out the website, and there's lots of ways for people to sign up for things, put their names on petitions. Like, all of the pressure matters.
All right, very important work. And Louise Smith, thank you so much for joining me today to talk a little bit about the work of Independent Jewish Voices and this very important issue. Thank you so much. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you.
That was Louise Smith from Independent Jewish Voices and Rabble editor Nick Seabrook in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Louise and Nick. Listeners, to get involved with the work Independent Jewish Voices does, please visit ijvcanada.org. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. Here to bring us up to date is Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Back to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in world news. This past Monday marked the one-year anniversary of the October 7th attack by Hamas that killed over 1,200 Israeli citizens. The attack led to a drastic escalation in violence against Palestinians by the Israeli state. In recent weeks, Israel has expanded that conflict into neighboring Lebanon. Freelance reporter Dairi Marif interviewed Palestinians living in Canada and asked them about the impacts the conflict has had on their lives. Palestinians like Nariman Azur, who has endured the anxiety of losing contact with members of their family trapped in war-torn Gaza, and then the tragic loss of their brother Mohammed, who was killed in an Israeli airstrike. In Canada, Azur has been subjected to harassment for expressing their Palestinian identity, which has included her wearing of a Palestinian keffiyeh scarf in public. Azur is undeterred, though. As a young mother, she has brought her daughter with her to her rallies in her community in support of Palestine. Staying in world news, Japan's new Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba is seeking to create a NATO-style alliance for neoliberal democracies in Asia. In an op-ed for Rabble, University of Victoria politics professors John Price and Midori Ogasawara explain the motivation behind this move and how it can lead to a greater militarization in the region. On the surface, Ishiba is trying to create an alliance to contain aggressive nuclear-powered neighbors, Russia, North Korea, and China. On a deeper level, Ishiba is also keen to reduce his country's reliance on the U.S. for defense, with assaults perpetrated by U.S. personnel on military bases on the Japanese island of Okinawa as just one driving factor. Japan, a country that has renounced the use of military force as a way to solve problems after World War II, has been becoming increasingly militarized in recent years, with the new Prime Minister Ishiba even raising the possibility of the country becoming a nuclear power itself.
In national news, Rabble parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg analyzed the rise and fall of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. In 2015, Trudeau swept to power by using his family's name recognition as well as positive vibes to topple Stephen Harper's Conservatives. The 2015 election was about more than just vibes, however. Trudeau also made a key policy promise that helped drive supporters to the polls. Trudeau had promised that the 2015 election would be the last under Canada's first-past-the-post electoral system. After he was elected, however, Trudeau quickly went back on that promise after it became clear that his preferred alternative, a ranked ballot system, was not the choice of his fellow Liberal colleagues and other members of the House of Commons. Ironically, with Trudeau's popularity at an all-time low and with the Liberals sinking in the polls, his failure to reform the electoral system will likely leave his party in the same shape that he found it, in third place and politically irrelevant. Also this week, a recent audit of the use of police body-worn cameras in Toronto is finding that the devices are often being misused and that they are not increasing the level of accountability for police officers as they were intended to. After reviewing 74 use-of-force incidents, auditors found that police officers failed to activate their body-worn cameras 26% of the time. Furthermore, the auditors found that the vast majority of body-worn camera footage was never even viewed, let alone reviewed by a supervising officer. Finally, join us for Off the Hill next week as we catch up on Canadian and U.S. politics. Join guests NDPNP Nikki Ashton, policy analyst Chuka Jekum, poet and activist L. Jones, and Rabble's own parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg as we break down the upcoming provincial elections in BC and Saskatchewan, as well as the upcoming presidential election south of our border. And wonder aloud, is an early federal election in Canada likely as well? Save your spot and join the conversation next week on October 16th, 2024 at 4:30 p.m. Pacific, 7:30 p.m. Eastern. Register for this free panel today on rabble.ca. As always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.